We make a scotch and water in this home?
No, sir, Gus said.
We pour scotch into a glass, and then call to mind thoughts of water, and then we mix the actual scotch with the abstracted idea of water.
Levi said, Perhaps a bit of breakfast first, Peter.
He looked toward us and stage whispered, She thinks I have a drinking problem.
And I think that the sun has risen, Levi responded.
Nonetheless, she turned to the bar in the living room, reached up for a bottle of scotch, and poured a glass half full. She carried it to him. Peter Van Houten took a sip, then sat up straight in his chair.
A drink this good deserves one's best posture, he said.
I became conscious of my own posture and sat up a little on the couch. I rearranged my cannula. Dad always told me that you can judge people by the way they treat waiters and assistants. By this measure, Peter Van Houten was possibly the world's douchiest douche.
So, you like my book, he said to Augustus after another sip.
Yeah, I said, speaking up on Augustus's behalf. And yes, we... Well, Augustus, he made meeting you his wish so that we could come here, so that you could tell us what happens after the end of an imperial affliction.
Van Houten said nothing, just took a long pull on his drink.
After a minute, Augustus said,
Your book is sort of the thing that brought us together.
But you aren't together, he observed without looking at me. The thing that brought us nearly together, I said. Now he turned to me.
Did you dress like her on purpose?
Anna? I asked. He just kept staring at me. Kind of, I said. He took a long drink, then grimaced.
I do not have a drinking problem, he announced, his voice needlessly loud. I have a Churchillian relationship with alcohol. I can crack jokes and govern England and do anything I want to do, except not drink.
He glanced over at Levi and nodded toward his glass. She took it, then walked back to the bar.
Just the idea of water, Levi, he instructed.
Yeah, got it, she said. The accent almost American.
The second drink arrived. Van Houten's spine stiffened again out of respect. He kicked off his slippers. He had really ugly feet. He was rather ruining the whole business of authorial genius for me, but he had the answers.
Well, I said, first, we do want to say thank you for dinner last night, and...
We bought them dinner last night? Van Houten asked Levi.
Yes. At Orange.
Yes. Well, believe me when I say that you do not have me to thank, but rather Levi, who is exceptionally talented in the field of spending my money.
It was our pleasure, Levi said.
Well, thanks at any rate, Augustus said.
I could hear annoyance in his voice.
So here I am, Van Houten said after a moment. What are your questions?
Augustus said.
He seemed so intelligent in print, Van Houten said to Levi regarding Augustus. Perhaps the cancer has established a beachhead in his brain.
Peter! Levi said, duly horrified. I was horrified, too. But there was something pleasant about a guy so despicable that he wouldn't treat us deferentially.
We do have some questions, actually, I said. I talked about them in my email. I don't know if you remember.
I do not.
His memory's compromised, Levi said.
If only my memory would compromise, Van Houten responded.
So, our questions, I repeated.
She uses the royal we, Peter said to no one in particular.
Another sip. I didn't know what scotch tasted like, but if it tasted anything like champagne... I couldn't imagine how he could drink so much, so quickly, so early in the morning.
Are you familiar with Zeno's tortoise paradox? He asked me.
We have questions about what happens to the characters after the end of the book, specifically Anna's...
You wrongly assume that I need to hear your question in order to answer it. You are familiar with the philosopher Zeno?
I shook my head vaguely.
Alas, Zeno was a pre-Socratic philosopher who is said to have discovered 40 paradoxes within the worldview put forth by Parmenides.
Surely you know Parmenides, he said, and I nodded that I knew Parmenides, although I did not.
Thank God, he said.
Zeno professionally specialized in revealing the inaccuracies and oversimplifications of Parmenides, which wasn't difficult, since Parmenides was spectacularly wrong everywhere and always. Parmenides is valuable in precisely the way that it is valuable to have an acquaintance who reliably picks the wrong horse each and every time you take him to the racetrack. But Zeno's most important... Wait, give me a sense of your familiarity with Swedish hip-hop.
I could not tell if Peter Van Houten was kidding. After a moment, Augustus answered for me.
Limited, he said.
Okay, but presumably you know Afasi Okfilti's seminal album Flaken.
We do not, I said for the both of us.
Lidevi, play Bomfalarala immediately.
Lidevi walked over to an MP3 player, spun the wheel a bit, then hit a button. A rap song boomed from every direction. It sounded like a fairly regular rap song, except the words were in Swedish. After it was over, Peter Van Houten looked at us expectantly, his little eyes as wide as they could get.
Yeah? He asked. Yeah?
I said, I'm sorry, sir, but we don't speak Swedish.
Well, of course you don't. Neither do I. Who the hell speaks Swedish? The important thing is not whatever nonsense the voices are saying, but what the voices are feeling. Surely you know that there are only two emotions, love and fear, and that Afasi Okfilti navigate between them with the kind of facility that one simply does not find in hip-hop music outside of Sweden. Shall I play it for you again?
Are you joking? Gus said.
Pardon?
Is this some kind of performance?
He looked up at Lidevi and asked,
Is it?
I'm afraid not, Lidevi answered. He's not always... This is unusually...
Oh, shut up, Lidevi. Rudolf Otto said that if you had not encountered the numinous, if you have not experienced a non-rational encounter with the mysterium tremendum, then his work was not for you. And I say to you, young friends, that if you cannot hear Afasi Okfilti's bravadic response to fear, then my work is not for you.
I cannot emphasize this enough. It was a completely normal rap song, except in Swedish. I said, so about an imperial affliction. Anna's mom, when the book ends, is about to...
Van Houten interrupted me, tapping his glass as he talked until Lidevi refilled it again.
So Zeno is most famous for his tortoise paradox. Let us imagine that you are in a race with a tortoise. The tortoise has a 10-yard head start. In the time it takes you to run that 10 yards, the tortoise has maybe moved 1 yard. And then in the time it takes you to make up that distance, the tortoise goes a bit farther, and so on, forever. You are faster than the tortoise, but you can never catch him. You can only decrease his lead. Of course. You just run past the tortoise without contemplating the mechanics involved. But the question of how you are able to do this turns out to be incredibly complicated, and no one really solved it until Cantor showed us that some infinities are bigger than other infinities.
I said.
I assume that answers your question,
he said confidently, then sipped generously from his glass.
Not really, I said.
We were wondering, after the end of an imperial affliction...
I disavow everything in that putrid novel,
Van Houten said, cutting me off.
No,
I said.
Excuse me?
No, that is not acceptable, I said. I understand that the story ends mid-narrative because Anna dies or becomes too sick to continue, but you said you would tell us what happens to everybody, and that's why we're here, and we... I need you to tell me.
Van Houten sighed.
After another drink, he said,
Very well. Whose story do you seek?
Anna's mom, the Dutch tulip man, Sisyphus the hamster. I mean, just what happens to everyone? Van Houten closed his eyes and puffed his cheeks as he exhaled, then looked up at the exposed wooden beams crisscrossing the ceiling.
The hamster,
he said after a while, The hamster gets adopted by Christine, who was one of Anna's pre-sickness friends. That made sense. Christine and Anna played with Sisyphus in a few scenes. He is adopted by Christine and lives for a couple years after the end of the novel and dies peacefully in his hamster sleep. Now we were getting somewhere. Great, I said. Great. Okay. So, the Dutch tulip man, is he a con man? Do he and Anna's mom get married? Van Houten was still staring at the ceiling beams. He took a drink. The glass was almost empty again.
Lidevi, I can't do it. I can't. I can't.
He leveled his gaze to me.
Nothing happens to the Dutch tulip man. He isn't a con man or not a con man. He's God. He's an obvious and unambiguous metaphorical representation of God, and asking what becomes of him is the intellectual equivalent of asking what becomes of the disembodied eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg in Gatsby. Do he and Anna's mom get married? We are speaking of a novel, dear child, not some historical enterprise.
Right, but surely you must have thought about what happens to them. I mean, as characters. I mean, independent of their metaphorical meanings or whatever.
They're fictions, he said, tapping his glass again. Nothing happens to them.
You said you'd tell me, I insisted. I reminded myself to be assertive. I needed to keep his addled attention on my questions.
Perhaps. But I was under the misguided impression that you were incapable of transatlantic travel. I was trying to provide you some comfort, I suppose, which I should know better than to attempt. But to be perfectly frank, this childish idea that the author of a novel has some special insight into the characters in the novel, it's ridiculous. That novel was composed of scratches on a page, dear. The characters inhabiting it have no life outside of those scratches. What happened to them? They all ceased to exist the moment the novel ended.
No, I said. I pushed myself up off the couch. No, I understand that, but it's impossible not to imagine a future for them. You are the most qualified person to imagine that future. Something happened to Anna's mother. She either got married or didn't. She either moved to Holland with the Dutch tulip man or didn't. She either had more kids or didn't. I need to know what happens to her.
Van Houten pursed his lips. I regret that I cannot indulge your childish whims, but I refuse to pity you in the manner to which you are well accustomed.
I don't want your pity, I said.
Like all sick children, he answered dispassionately, you say you don't want pity, but your very existence depends upon it.
Peter, Lidevi said. But he continued as he reclined there, his words getting rounder in his drunken mouth.
Sick children inevitably become arrested. You are fated to live out your days as the child you were when you were diagnosed. The child who believes there is life after a novel ends. And we, as adults, we pity this. So we pay for your treatments, for your oxygen machines. We give you food and water, though you are unlikely to live long enough.
Peter! Lidevi shouted.
You are a side effect, Van Houten continued, of an evolutionary process that cares little for individual lives. You are a failed experiment in mutation.
I resign, Lidevi shouted. There were tears in her eyes. But I wasn't angry. He was looking for the most hurtful way to tell the truth, but of course I already knew the truth. I'd had years of staring at ceilings from my bedroom to the ICU, and so I long ago found the most hurtful ways to imagine my own illness. I stepped toward him.
Listen, douche pants, I said. You're not going to tell me anything about disease I don't already know. I need one and only one thing from you before I walk out of your life forever. What happens to Anna's mother?
He raised his flabby chins vaguely toward me and shrugged his shoulders.
I can no more tell you what happens to her Then I can tell you what becomes of Proust's narrator or Holden Caulfield's sister or Huckleberry Finn after he lights out for the territories. Bullshit! That's bullshit! Just tell me. Make something up. No, and I'll thank you not to curse in my house. It isn't becoming of a lady.
I still wasn't angry exactly, but I was very focused on getting the thing I'd been promised. Something inside me welled up, and I reached down and smacked the swollen hand that held the glass of scotch. What remained of the scotch splashed across the vast expanse of his face, the glass bouncing off his nose and then spinning balletically through the air, landing with a shattering crash on the ancient hardwood floors.
Levi, Van Houten said calmly, I'll have a martini, if you please. Just a whisper of vermouth.
I have resigned, Levi said after a moment.
Don't be ridiculous.
I didn't know what to do. Being nice hadn't worked. Being mean hadn't worked. I needed an answer. I'd come all this way. Hijacked Augustus's wish. I needed to know.
Have you ever stopped to wonder,
he said, his words slurring now,
why you care so much about your silly questions?
You promised!
I shouted, hearing Isaac's impotent wailing echoing from the night of the broken trophies. Van Houten didn't reply. I was still standing over him, waiting for him to say something to me when I felt Augustus's hand on my arm. He pulled me away toward the door, and I followed him while Van Houten ranted to Levi about the ingratitude of contemporary teenagers and the death of polite society, and Levi, somewhat hysterical, shouted back at him in rapid-fire Dutch.
You'll have to forgive my former assistant, he said. Dutch is not so much a language as an ailment of the throat.
Augustus pulled me out of the room and through the door to the late spring morning and the falling confetti of the elms. For me, there was no such thing as a quick getaway. But we made our way down the stairs, Augustus holding my cart, and then started to walk back toward the Philosoph on a bumpy sidewalk of interwoven rectangular bricks. For the first time since the swing set, I started crying.
Hey, he said, touching my hips. Hey, it's okay.
I nodded and wiped my face with the back of my hand.
He sucks.
I nodded again.
I'll write you an epilogue,
Gus said. That made me cry harder.
I will, he said. I will. Better than any shit that drunk could write. His brain is Swiss cheese. He doesn't even remember writing the book. I can write 10 times the story that guy can. There will be blood and guts and sacrifice. An imperial affliction meets the price of dawn. You'll love it.
I kept nodding, faking a smile, and then he hugged me, his strong arms pulling me into his muscular chest, and I sogged up his polo shirt a little, but then recovered enough to speak.
I spent your wish on that douche face,
I said into his chest.
Hazel Grace.
No. I will grant you that you did spend my one and only wish, but you did not spend it on him. You spent it on us. Behind us, I heard the plonk-plonk of high heels running. I turned around. It was Levi, her eyeliner running down her cheeks, duly horrified, chasing us up the sidewalk.
Perhaps we should go to the Anna Frank house, Levi said.
I'm not going anywhere with that monster, Augustus said.
He is not invited, Levi said.
Augustus kept holding me, protective, his hand on the side of my face.
I don't think, he started, but I cut him off.
We should go.
I still wanted answers from Van Houten, but it wasn't all I wanted. I only had 2 days left in Amsterdam with Augustus Waters. I wouldn't let a sad old man ruin them. Levi drove a clunky gray Fiat with an engine that sounded like an excited 4-year-old girl. As we drove through the streets of Amsterdam, she repeatedly and profusely apologized.
I am very sorry. There is no excuse. He is very sick. she said. I thought meeting you would help him, if he would see that his work has shaped real lives, but I'm very sorry. It is very, very embarrassing.
Neither Augustus nor I said anything. I was in the back seat behind him. I snuck my hand between the side of the car and his seat, feeling for his hand, but I couldn't find it. Ledevi continued.
I have continued this work because I believe he is a genius, and because the pay is very good. But he has become a monster.
I guess he got pretty rich on that book, I said after a while.
Oh, no, no. He is of the Van Houtens, she said. In the 17th century, his ancestor discovered how to mix cocoa into water. Some Van Houtens moved to the United States long ago, and Peter is one of those. But he moved to Holland after his novel. He is an embarrassment to a great family.
The engine screamed. Ledevi shifted and we shot up a canal bridge.
It is circumstance, she said. Circumstance has made him so cruel. He is not an evil man, but this day I did not think. When he said these terrible things, I could not believe it. I am very sorry. Very, very sorry.
We had to park a block away from the Anne Frank house. And then, while Ledevi stood in line to get tickets for us, I sat with my back against a little tree, looking at all the moored houseboats in the Prinsengracht Canal. Augustus was standing above me, rolling my oxygen cart in lazy circles, just watching the wheels spin. I wanted him to sit next to me, but I knew it was hard for him to sit, and harder still to stand back up.
"Okay?"
he asked, looking down at me. I shrugged and reached a hand for his calf. It was his fake calf, but I held on to it. He looked down at me.
I wanted, I said.
I know, he said. I know. Apparently the world is not a wish-granting factory. That made me smile a little. Ledevi returned with tickets, but her thin lips were pursed with worry.
There is no elevator, she said. I am very, very sorry.
It's okay, I said.
No, there are many stairs, she said. Steep stairs.
It's okay, I said again. Augustus started to say something, but I interrupted.
It's okay. I can do it.
We began in a room with a video about Jews in Holland and the Nazi invasion and the Frank family. Then we walked upstairs into the canal house where Otto Frank's business had been. The stairs were slow, for me and Augustus both, but I felt strong. Soon I was staring at the famous bookcase that had hid Anne Frank, her family, and four others. The bookcase was half open, and behind it was an even steeper set of stairs, only wide enough for one person. There were fellow visitors all around us, and I didn't want to hold up the procession, but Ledevi said,
"If everyone could be patient, please."
And I began the walk up, Ledevi carrying the cart behind me, Gus behind her. It was 14 steps. I kept thinking about the people behind me. They were mostly adults, speaking a variety of languages, and feeling embarrassed or whatever, feeling like a ghost that both comforts and haunts. But finally I made it up, and then I was in an eerily empty room, leaning against the wall, my brain telling my lungs, it's okay, calm down, it's okay. And my lungs telling my brain, oh God, we're dying here. I didn't even see Augustus come upstairs, but he came over and wiped his brow with the back of his hand like, whew, and said, you're a champion. After a few minutes of wall leaning, I made it to the next room, which Anne had shared with the dentist Fritz Pfeffer. It was tiny, empty of all furniture. You'd never know anyone had ever lived there, except that the pictures Anne had pasted onto the wall from magazines and newspapers were still there. Another staircase led up to the room where the Van Pels family had lived, this one steeper than the last and 18 steps, essentially a glorified ladder. I got to the threshold and looked up and figured I could not do it, but also knew the only way through was up.
"Let's go back," Gus said behind me.
"I'm okay," I answered quietly. It's stupid, but I kept thinking I owed it to her. To Anne Frank, I mean. Because she was dead and I wasn't.
because she had stayed quiet and kept the blinds drawn and done everything right and still died, and so I should go up the steps and see the rest of the world she'd lived in those years before the Gestapo came. I began to climb the stairs, crawling up them like a little kid would, slow at first so I could breathe, but then faster because I knew I couldn't breathe and wanted to get to the top before everything gave out. The blackness encroached around my field of vision as I pulled myself up, 18 steps, steep as hell. I finally crested the staircase, mostly blind and nauseated, the muscles in my arms and legs screaming for oxygen. I slumped seated against a wall, heaving watered-down coughs. There was an empty glass case bolted to the wall above me, and I stared up through it to the ceiling and tried not to pass out. Lidovai crouched down next to me, saying, "You are at the top. That is it." And I nodded. I had a vague awareness of the adults all around glancing down at me worriedly, of Lidovai speaking quietly in one language and then another to various visitors, of Augustus standing above me, his hand on the top of my head, stroking my hair along the part. After a long time, Lidovai and Augustus pulled me to my feet, and I saw what was protected by the glass case. Pencil marks on the wallpaper measuring the growth of all the children in the annex during the period they lived there, inch after inch, until they would grow no more. From there, we left the Franks' living area, but we were still in the museum. A long, narrow hallway showed pictures of each of the annex's 8 residents and described how and where and when they died. "The only member of his whole family who survived the war," Lidovai told us, referring to Anne's father, Otto. Her voice was hushed like we were in church. "But he didn't survive a war, not really," Augustus said. "He survived a genocide."
"True," Lidovai said. "I do not know how you go on without your family. I do not know."
As I read about each of the 7 who died, I thought of Otto Frank not being a father anymore, left with a diary instead of a wife and 2 daughters. At the end of the hallway, a huge book, bigger than a dictionary, contained the names of the 103,000 dead from the Netherlands in the Holocaust. Only 5,000 of the deported Dutch Jews, a wall label explained, had survived. 5,000 Otto Franks. The book was turned to the page with Anne Frank's name, but what got me about it was the fact that right beneath her name there were 4 Aaron Franks.
4.
4 Aaron Franks without museums, without historical markers, without anyone to mourn them. I silently resolved to remember and pray for the 4 Aaron Franks as long as I was around. Maybe some people need to believe in a proper and omnipotent God to pray, but I don't. As we got to the end of the room, Gus stopped and said, "You okay?" I nodded. He gestured back toward Anne's picture. "The worst part is that she almost lived, you know. She died weeks away from liberation." Lidovai took a few steps away to watch a video, and I grabbed Augustus's hand as we walked into the next room. It was an A-frame room with some letters Otto Frank had written to people during his months-long search for his daughters. On the wall in the middle of the room, a video of Otto Frank played. He was speaking in English. "Are there any Nazis left that I could hunt down and bring to justice?" Augustus asked while we leaned over the vitrines, reading Otto's letters and the gutting replies that no, no one had seen his children after the liberation. "I think they're all dead. But it's not like the Nazis had a monopoly on evil."
"True," he said. "That's what we should do, Hazel Grace. We should team up and be this disabled vigilante duo roaring through the world, righting wrongs, defending the weak, protecting the endangered."
Although it was his dream and not mine, I indulged it. He'd indulged mine, after all. "Our fearlessness shall be our secret weapon," I said.
"The tales of our exploits will survive as long as the human voice itself," he said.
"And even after that, when the robots recall the human absurdities of sacrifice and compassion, they will remember us."
"They will robot laugh at our courageous folly," he said.
"But something in their iron robot hearts will yearn to have lived and died as we did on the hero's errand."
Augustus Waters, I said, looking up at him. Thinking that you cannot kiss anyone in the Anne Frank house, and then thinking that Anne Frank, after all, kissed someone in the Anne Frank house, and that she would probably like nothing more than for her home to have become a place where the young and irreparably broken sink into love.
I must say, Otto Frank said on the video in his accented English, I was very much surprised by the deep thoughts Anna had.
And then we were kissing. My hand let go of the oxygen cart, and I reached up for his neck, and he pulled me up by my waist onto my tiptoes. As his parted lips met mine, I started to feel breathless in a new and fascinating way. The space around us evaporated, and for a weird moment I really liked my body. This cancer-ruined thing I'd spent years dragging around suddenly seemed worth the struggle, worth the chest tubes and the PICC lines and the ceaseless bodily betrayal of the tumors. It was quite a different Anna I had known as my daughter. She never really showed this kind of inner feeling, Otto Frank continued. The kiss lasted forever as Otto Frank kept talking from behind me.
And my conclusion is, he said, since I had been in very good terms with Anna, that most parents don't know really their children.
I realized that my eyes were closed and opened them. Augustus was staring at me, his blue eyes closer to me than they'd ever been. And behind him, a crowd of people three deep had sort of circled around us. They were angry, I thought, horrified. These teenagers, with their hormones, making out beneath a video broadcasting the shattered voice of a former father. I pulled away from Augustus, and he snuck a peck onto my forehead as I stared down at my Chuck Taylors. And then they started clapping. All the people, all these adults, just started clapping, and one shouted, Bravo! In a European accent. Augustus, smiling, bowed. Laughing, I curtsied ever so slightly, which was met with another round of applause. We made our way downstairs, letting all the adults go down first, and right before we got to the cafe, where blessedly an elevator took us back down to ground level and the gift shop, we saw pages of Anne's diary, and also her unpublished book of quotations. The quote book happened to be turned to a page of Shakespeare quotations. For who so firm that cannot be seduced? She'd written. Lidovai drove us back to the Philosoph. Outside the hotel, it was drizzling, and Augustus and I stood on the brick sidewalk, slowly getting wet.
Augustus, you probably need some rest.
Me, I'm okay.
Augustus, okay.
What are you thinking about?
Me,
you,
Augustus. What about me?
Me. I do not know which to prefer, the beauty of inflections or the beauty of innuendos, the blackbird whistling or just after.
Augustus, God, you are sexy.
Me. We could go to your room.
Augustus, I've heard worse ideas.
We squeezed into the tiny elevator together. Every surface, including the floor, was mirrored. We had to pull the door to shut ourselves in, and then the old thing creaked slowly up to the second floor. I was tired and sweaty and worried that I generally looked and smelled gross. But even so, I kissed him in that elevator. And then he pulled away and pointed at the mirror and said, Look, infinite hazels.
Some infinities are larger than other infinities, I drawled, mimicking Van Houten.
What an ass clown, Augustus said, and it took all that time and more just to get us to the second floor. Finally, the elevator lurched to a halt, and he pushed the mirrored door open. When it was half open, he winced in pain and lost his grip on the door for a second. You okay? I asked. After a second, he said,
Yeah, door's just heavy, I guess.
He pushed again and got it open. He let me walk out first, of course, but then I didn't know which direction to walk down the hallway, and so I just stood there outside the elevator, and he stood there too, his face still contorted, and I said again, Okay?
Just out of shape, Hazel Grace.
All is well.
We were just standing there in the hallway, and he wasn't leading the way to his room or anything, and I didn't know where his room was. And as the stalemate continued, I became convinced he was trying to figure out a way not to hook up with me, that I never should have suggested the idea in the first place, that it was unladylike and therefore had disgusted Augustus Waters, who was standing there looking at me unblinking, trying to think of a way to extricate himself from the situation politely. And then, after forever, he said, "It's above my knee and it just tapers a little and then it's just skin. There's a nasty scar, but it looks like..." "What?" I asked. "My leg," he said. "Just so you're prepared in case... I mean, in case you see it or what..."
"Oh, get over yourself," I said, and took the 2 steps I needed to get to him.
I kissed him, hard, pressing him against the wall, and I kept kissing him as he fumbled for the room key. We crawled into the bed, my freedom circumscribed some by the oxygen, but even so I could get on top of him and take his shirt off and taste the sweat on the skin below his collarbone as I whispered into his skin, "I love you, Augustus Waters," his body relaxing beneath mine as he heard me say it. He reached down and tried to pull my shirt off, but it got tangled in the tube. I laughed.
"How do you do this every day?" he asked as I disentangled my shirt from the tubes.
Idiotically, it occurred to me that my pink underwear didn't match my purple bra, as if boys even noticed such things. I crawled under the covers and kicked out of my jeans and socks and then watched the comforter dance as beneath it, Augustus removed first his jeans and then his leg. We were lying on our backs next to each other, everything hidden by the covers. And after a second, I reached over for his thigh and let my hand trail downward to the stump, the thick, scarred skin. I held the stump for a second. He flinched. "It hurts?" I asked.
"No,"
he said. He flipped himself onto his side and kissed me.
"You're so hot,"
I said, my hand still on his leg.
"I'm starting to think you have an amputee fetish," he answered, still kissing me.
I laughed.
"I have an Augustus Waters fetish," I explained.
The whole affair was the precise opposite of what I figured it would be. Slow and patient and quiet, and neither particularly painful nor particularly ecstatic. There were a lot of condomy problems that I did not get a particularly good look at. No headboards were broken. No screaming. Honestly, it was probably the longest time we'd ever spent together without talking. Only one thing followed type. Afterward, when I had my face resting against Augustus's chest, listening to his heart pound, Augustus said,
"Hazel Grace, I literally cannot keep my eyes open."
"Misuse of literality," I said.
"No," he said. "So tired."
His face turned away from me, my ear pressed to his chest, listening to his lungs settle into the rhythm of sleep. After a while, I got up, dressed, found the Hotel Philosophe stationery, and wrote him a love letter. I wrote, "Dearest Augustus." Then I drew a large circle and wrote, "Virgins," inside it. I drew a tiny circle on the edge of the big circle and labeled it, 17-year-old guys with one leg. There was a lot of overlap, but it was no longer 100%. And then I signed it, "Yours, Hazel Grace." Chapter 13. The next morning, our last full day in Amsterdam, Mom and Augustus and I walked the half block from the hotel to the Vondelpark, where we found a café in the shadow of the Dutch National Film Museum. Over lattes, which, the waiter explained to us, the Dutch called wrong coffee, because it had more milk than coffee, we sat in the lacy shade of a huge chestnut tree and recounted for Mom our encounter with the great Peter Van Houten. We made the story funny. You have a choice in this world, I believe, about how to tell sad stories, and we made the funny choice. Augustus, slumped in the cafe chair, pretended to be the tongue-tied, word-slurring Van Houten who could not so much as push himself out of his chair. I stood up to play a me all full of bluster and machismo, shouting, "Get up, you fat, ugly old man!"
"Did you call him ugly?"
Augustus asked. "Just go with it," I told him.
"I'm not ugly. You're the ugly one, nose tube girl."
"You're a coward," I rumbled, and Augustus broke character to laugh. I sat down. We told Mom about the Anne Frank house, leaving out the kissing.
"Did you go back to Shea Van Houten afterward?" Mom asked.
Augustus didn't even give me time to blush.
"Nah, we just hung out at a cafe. Hazel amused me with some Venn diagram humor."
He glanced at me. God, he was sexy.
"Sounds lovely," she said.
"Listen, I'm going to go for a walk. Give the two of you time to talk," she said at Gus, an edge in it. "Then maybe later we can go for a tour on a canal boat."
Okay, I said.
Mom left a 5-euro note under her saucer and then kissed me on the top of the head, whispering, "I love, love, love you," which was two more loves than usual. Gus motioned down to the shadows of the branches intersecting and coming apart on the concrete.
"Beautiful, huh?"
"Yeah," I said.
"Such a good metaphor," he mumbled.
"Is it now?"
I asked.
"The negative image of things blown together and then blown apart," he said. Before us, hundreds of people passed, jogging and biking and rollerblading. Amsterdam was a city designed for movement and activity. A city that would rather not travel by car, and so inevitably I felt excluded from it. But God, was it beautiful! The creek carving a path around the huge tree, a heron standing still at the water's edge, searching for a breakfast amid the millions of elm petals floating in the water. But Augustus didn't notice. He was too busy watching the shadows move. Finally, he said,
"I could look at this all day, but we should go to the hotel."
"Do we have time?" I asked. He smiled sadly.
"If only," he said.
"What's wrong?" I asked. He nodded back in the direction of the hotel. We walked in silence, Augustus a half step in front of me. I was too scared to ask if I had reason to be scared. "So there is this thing called Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Basically, this guy, Abraham Maslow, became famous for his theory that certain needs must be met before you can even have other kinds of needs. It's like this. Once your needs for food and water are fulfilled, you move up to the next set of needs, security, and then the next and the next. But the important thing is that, according to Maslow, until your physiological needs are satisfied, you can't even worry about security or social needs, let alone self-actualization, which is when you start to, like, make art and think about morality and quantum physics and stuff. According to Maslow, I was stuck on the second level, unable to feel secure in my health and therefore unable to reach for love and respect and art and whatever else, which is, of course, utter horse shit. The urge to make art or contemplate philosophy does not go away when you are sick. Those urges just become transfigured by illness. Maslow's theory seemed to imply that I was less human than other people, and most people seemed to agree with him. But not Augustus. I always thought he could love me because he'd once been sick. Only now did it occur to me that maybe he still was. We arrived in my room, the Kierkegaard. I sat down on the bed expecting him to join me, but he hunkered down in the dusty paisley chair. That chair. How old was it? 50 years? I felt the ball in the base of my throat hardening as I watched him pull a cigarette from his pack and stick it between his lips. He leaned back and sighed.
"Just before you went into the ICU, I started to feel this ache in my hip."
"No," I said. Panic rolled in, pulled me under. He nodded.
"So I went in for a PET scan."
He stopped. He yanked the cigarette out of his mouth and clenched his teeth. Much of my life had been devoted to trying not to cry in front of people who loved me, so I knew what Augustus was doing. You clench your teeth. You look up. You tell yourself that if they see you cry, it will hurt them, and you will be nothing but a sadness in their lives, and you must not become a mere sadness, so you will not cry. And you say all of this to yourself while looking up at the ceiling, and then you swallow, even though your throat does not want to close, and you look at the person who loves you and smile. He flashed his crooked smile, then said, "I lit up like a Christmas tree, Hazel Grace. The lining of my chest, my left hip, my liver, everywhere. Everywhere." That word hung in the air a while. We both knew what it meant. I got up, dragging my body and the cart across carpet that was older than Augustus would ever be, and I knelt at the base of the chair and put my head in his lap and hugged him by the waist. He was stroking my hair.
"I'm so sorry," I said.
"I'm sorry I didn't tell you," he said, his voice calm. "Your mom must know, the way she looked at me. My mom must have just told her or something. I should have told you. It was stupid, selfish." I knew why he hadn't said anything, of course. The same reason I hadn't wanted him to see me in the ICU. I couldn't be mad at him for even a moment, and only now that I loved a grenade did I understand the foolishness of trying to save others from my own impending fragmentation. I couldn't unlove Augustus Waters, and I didn't want to.
"It's not fair," I said. "It's just so goddamn unfair."
"The world," he said, "is not a wish-granting factory." And then he broke down. Just for one moment, his sob roaring impotent like a clap of thunder unaccompanied by lightning, the terrible ferocity that amateurs in the field of suffering might mistake for weakness. Then he pulled me to him and, his face inches from mine, resolved,
"I'll fight it. I'll fight it for you. Don't you worry about me, Hazel Grace. I'm okay. I'll find a way to hang around and annoy you for a long time."
I was crying. But even then he was strong, holding me tight so that I could see the sinewy muscles of his arms wrapped around me as he said, "I'm sorry. You'll be okay. It'll be okay. I promise." And smiled his crooked smile. He kissed my forehead, and then I felt his powerful chest deflate just a little.
I guess I had a hamartia after all.
After a while, I pulled him over to the bed and we lay there together as he told me they'd started palliative chemo, but he gave it up to go to Amsterdam, even though his parents were furious. They'd tried to stop him right up until that morning, when I heard him screaming that his body belonged to him.
"We could have rescheduled," I said.
"No, we couldn't have," he answered. "Anyway, it wasn't working. I could tell it wasn't working, you know." I nodded.
"It's just bullshit. The whole thing," I said.
"They'll try something else when I get home. They've always got a new idea."
"Yeah," I said, having been the experimental pincushion myself.
"I kind of conned you into believing you were falling in love with a healthy person," he said.
I shrugged. "I'd have done the same to you."
"No, you wouldn't have. But we can't all be as awesome as you."
He kissed me, then grimaced.
"Does it hurt?" I asked. "No, just..."
He stared at the ceiling for a long time before saying,
"I like this world. I like drinking champagne. I like not smoking. I like the sound of Dutch people speaking Dutch. And now I don't even get a battle. I don't get a fight."
"You get to battle cancer," I said. "That is your battle. And you'll keep fighting," I told him.
I hated it when people tried to build me up to prepare for battle, but I did it to him anyway.
You'll live your best life today. This is your war now."
I despised myself for the cheesy sentiment, but what else did I have?
"Some war," he said dismissively. "What am I at war with?"
My cancer. And what is my cancer? My cancer is me. The tumors are made of me. They're made of me as surely as my brain and my heart are made of me. It is a civil war, Hazel Grace, with a predetermined winner.
Gus, I said.
I couldn't say anything else. He was too smart for the kinds of solace I could offer.
Okay, he said.
But it wasn't.
After a moment, he said, If you go to the Rijksmuseum, which I really wanted to do, but who are we kidding? Neither of us can walk through a museum. But anyway, I looked at the collection online before we left. If you were to go, and hopefully someday you will, you would see a lot of paintings of dead people. You'd see Jesus on the cross, and you'd see a dude getting stabbed in the neck, and you'd see people dying at sea and in battle and a parade of martyrs. But not one single cancer kid. Nobody biting it from the plague or smallpox or yellow fever or whatever, because there is no glory in illness. There is no meaning to it. There is no honor in dying of.
Abraham Maslow, I present to you Augustus Waters, whose existential curiosity dwarfed that of his well-fed, well-loved, healthy brethren. While the mass of men went on leading thoroughly unexamined lives of monstrous consumption, Augustus Waters examined the collection of the Rijksmuseum from afar.
What? Augustus asked after a while.
Nothing, I said. I'm just... I couldn't finish the sentence. Didn't know how to. I'm just very, very fond of you.
He smiled with half his mouth, his nose inches from mine. The feeling is mutual. I don't suppose you can forget about it and treat me like I'm not dying.
I don't think you're dying, I said. I think you've just got a touch of cancer.
He smiled, gallows humor. I'm on a roller coaster that only goes up, he said.
And it is my privilege and my responsibility to ride all the way up with you, I said.
Would it be absolutely ludicrous to try to make out?
There is no try, I said. There is only do.
Chapter 14. On the flight home, 20,000 feet above clouds that were 10,000 feet above the ground, Gus said, I used to think it would be fun to live on a cloud.
Yeah, I said, like it would be like one of those inflatable moonwalk machines, except for always.
But then in middle school science, Mr. Martinez asked who among us had ever fantasized about living in the clouds, and everyone raised their hand. Then Mr. Martinez told us that up in the clouds the wind blew 150 miles an hour and the temperature was 30 below zero and there was no oxygen and we'd all die within seconds.
Sounds like a nice guy.
He specialized in the murder of dreams, Hazel Grace, let me tell you. You think volcanoes are awesome? Tell that to the 10,000 screaming corpses at Pompeii. You still secretly believe that there is an element of magic to this world? It's all just soulless molecules bouncing against each other randomly. Do you worry about who will take care of you if your parents die? As well you should, because they will be worm food in the fullness of time.
Ignorance is bliss, I said.
A flight attendant walked through the aisle with a beverage cart, half whispering,
Drinks, drinks, drinks,
drinks. Gus leaned over me, raising his hand.
Could we have some champagne, please?
You're 21?
She asked dubiously.
I conspicuously rearranged the nubbins in my nose.
The stewardess smiled, then glanced down at my sleeping mother.
She won't mind?
She asked of Mom.
Nah, I said.
So she poured champagne into two plastic cups.
Cancer perks.
Gus and I toasted.
To you.
He said.
To you, I said, touching my cup to his.
We sipped. Dimmer stars than we'd had at Orange, but still good enough to drink. You know, Gus said to me, everything Van Houten said was true.
Maybe, but he didn't have to be such a douche about it. I can't believe he imagined a future for Sisyphus the hamster, but not for Anna's mom.
Augustus shrugged. He seemed to zone out all of a sudden.
Okay, I asked.
He shook his head microscopically.
Hurts,
he said.
Chest?
He nodded. Fists clenched. Later, he would describe it as a one-legged fat man wearing a stiletto heel standing on the middle of his chest. I returned my seatback tray to its upright and locked position and bent forward to dig pills out of his backpack. He swallowed one with champagne.
"Okay?" I asked again.
Gus sat there, pumping his fist, waiting for the medicine to work, the medicine that did not kill the pain so much as distance him from it, and from me.
"It was like it was personal,"
Gus said quietly, like he was mad at us for some reason. Van Houten, I mean. He drank the rest of his champagne in a quick series of gulps and soon fell asleep. My dad was waiting for us in baggage claim, standing amid all the limo drivers in suits holding signs printed with the last names of their passengers. Johnson, Barrington, Carmichael. Dad had a sign of his own. "My beautiful family," it read, and then underneath that, "and Gus." I hugged him, and he started crying, of course. As we drove home, Gus and I told Dad stories of Amsterdam, but it wasn't until I was home and hooked up to Philip watching good old American television with Dad and eating American pizza off napkins on our laps that I told him about Gus.
"Gus had a recurrence," I said.
"I know," he said. He scooted over toward me and then added, "His mom told us before the trip. I'm sorry he kept it from you. I'm sorry, Hazel." I didn't say anything for a long time. The show we were watching was about people who are trying to pick which house they are going to buy.
"So I read An Imperial Affliction while you guys were gone," Dad said.
I turned my head up to him.
"Oh, cool.
What did you think?"
"It was good. A little over my head. I was a biochemistry major, remember, not a literature guy. I do wish it had ended."
"Yeah," I said. "Common complaint."
"Also, it was a bit hopeless," he said. "A bit defeatist."
"If by defeatist you mean honest, then I agree."
"I don't think defeatism is honest," Dad answered. "I refuse to accept that."
"So everything happens for a reason, and we'll all go live in the clouds and play harps and live in mansions?" Dad smiled. He put a big arm around me and pulled me to him, kissing the side of my head.
"I don't know what I believe, Hazel. I thought being an adult meant knowing what you believe, but that has not been my experience."
"Yeah," I said. "Okay." He told me again that he was sorry about Gus, and then we went back to watching the show, and the people picked a house, and Dad still had his arm around me, and I was kinda starting to fall asleep, but I didn't want to go to bed, and then Dad said, "You know what I believe? I remember in college I was taking this math class, this really great math class taught by this tiny old woman. She was talking about fast Fourier transforms, and she stopped mid-sentence and said, 'Sometimes it seems the universe wants to be noticed.' That's what I believe. I believe the universe wants to be noticed. I think the universe is improbably biased toward consciousness, that it rewards intelligence in part because the universe enjoys its elegance being observed. And who am I, living in the middle of history, to tell the universe that it, or my observation of it, is temporary?"
"You are fairly smart," I said after a while.
"You are fairly good at compliments," he answered. The next afternoon, I drove over to Gus's house and ate peanut butter and jelly sandwiches with his parents and told them stories about Amsterdam while Gus napped on the living room couch where we'd watched V for Vendetta. I could just see him from the kitchen. He lay on his back, head turned away from me, a pick line already in. They were attacking the cancer with a new cocktail. 2 chemo drugs and a protein receptor that they hoped would turn off the oncogene in Gus's cancer. He was lucky to get enrolled in the trial, they told me. Lucky. I knew one of the drugs. Hearing the sound of its name made me want to barf. After a while, Isaac's mom brought him over. "Isaac, hi. It's Hazel from support group, not your evil ex-girlfriend." His mom walked him to me, and I pulled myself out of the dining room chair and hugged him, his body taking a moment to find me before he hugged me back, hard. "How was Amsterdam?" he asked. "Awesome," I said. "Waters," he said. "Where are you, bro?"
"He's napping," I said, and my voice caught. Isaac shook his head. Everyone quiet.
Sucks,
Isaac said after a second. His mom walked him to a chair she'd pulled out. He sat.
I can still dominate your blind ass at counterinsurgents,
Augustus said without turning toward us. The medicine slowed his speech a bit, but only to the speed of regular people.
I'm pretty sure all asses are blind,
Isaac answered, reaching his hands into the air vaguely, looking for his mom. She grabbed him, pulled him up, and they walked over to the couch where Gus and I